with a hymn like that, it makes me want to say there is no faith like the Christian faith. It is a complete faith which covers every eventuality. And it makes provision for every need that you and I can ever have. Now, I remember Stuart's reference this morning to quotes, and I did quake in my shoes a bit, because I always have a number of quotes. Stuart, where's Stuart? And it just makes me wonder now, do I throw away half of what I have to say, or do I say it? But in defiance of what he said. By the way, he was also quoting from the scriptures. But I feel I need to set the stage, so to speak, so that we can understand or get an objective view of what I want to say thereafter. By quoting, you certainly scientist Jeremy Rifkin in a work called Algony of 1983. He said, "We no longer feel ourselves to be guests in someone else's home, and therefore obliged to make our behavior conform with a set of pre-existing cosmic rules. It is our creation now. We make the rules. We establish the parameters of reality. We create the world. And because we do, we no longer feel beholden to outside forces. We no longer have to justify our behavior, for we are now the architects of the universe. We are responsible to nothing outside ourselves, for we are the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever." A staggering statement by the kind of arrogance that evolutionistic thinking promotes and provokes. Now, I'm to speak about the scientific content of evolutionary doctrine. And what he couldn't hear on his recording or couldn't see is my inverted commas, so I will say scientific so-called content of the evolutionary doctrine. So, with a title like that, I am rather in mind to say, well, the scientific content of evolutionary doctrine is null, and then to go and sit down. But I don't think any of you would appreciate that, because then you would be queuing up to demand part of your conference fees back. So I will go on. Now, to say that evolution, or evolutionary doctrine, has no scientific content might sound rather arrogant, as if I presume to know all there is to know on the subject. Obviously, I do not, because I have no scientific qualification whatsoever. But I'm not alone, since Darwin didn't either. In fact, as I said in my previous talk, he was a minister of the word. That was his training. And as time progressed, he further and further drifted away from the certainties of the scriptures to the so-called certainties of so-called science. But I have been making a study of the subject for many, many years. Many years more than most of you sitting here. In fact, I believe, in a certain sense, it is better to be an outsider like myself than to be inside the whole sphere and aura of science. Because being on the inside often makes it difficult to step back and to objectively look at the subject because of one word, and that is preconceptions. The practice of science is riddled with preconceptions. Or should I rather say, not the practice of science, but the beliefs, pre-existing beliefs, that are applied, particularly, and distributed to the public out there. Because in the practice of science, in going into a laboratory, it has nothing to do with evolution whatsoever. It's the talk outside of that. It is the implanting of in the minds of the public that evolution provided all of this, which is the real problem. I mean, there are some areas of science where you needn't ever mention evolution at all. But the one area where evolution figures dramatically is paleontology, and we will come to that a bit later. I mean, the very bones of paleontology, and the pun is intended, has an incurably evolutionistic basis. So the whole thing would fall apart if evolution were not to be true. Genetics is another case in point, where evolution has led millions of people to believe in the infallibility of this latest fad of tracking your mitochondrial DNA history until you land up as the offspring of an African Eve some millions of years ago. Now, I could read to you from that new book of mine there, The Hoax of Darwinism and the African Eve, because therein you will see how they came about to put forward this doctrine, which appears to be absolutely infallible. I attended the inaugural address in Cape Town when this was brought to South Africa in the waterfront, and as I was sitting there, it just seemed so watertight that through DNA you could work back to find your offspring through an African Eve in Southern Africa, as I said, some millions of years ago. And it is so scientific, how can you argue with that? Until I read a book which Johan Kreer here has got in his bookshelf, not here, I didn't see it here, a book by Martin Lubino, Bones of Contention, which is a book very worthwhile reading, wherein he shows that the presupposition of these guys that are presenting this whole vehicle to prove your DNA background right to the first day, that all of that has a presupposition, is that word again, a presupposition that humans came from chimpanzees. So their whole computer program is based on falsehood that we come from chimpanzees. And one of the authors, the six authors of this whole theory, this DNA theory of mitochondrial DNA, backed out of it and admitted it was totally untrue. And there are many other references I could make which are in that book lying down there, which certainly bears reading for you to be an informed minister of the word in the first place, but also parent of children who are learning this nonsense at school. Now, another thing I ought to say about science per se is that there are so many disciplines within science that the one chap in this discipline knows nothing about what is happening in that. So what does he do about what that man says? Well, he accepts what he says because he is the expert. He knows what he's talking about. I don't know anything about that. I'm a geneticist, so I know nothing about paleontology. Now, I'll give you one example I experienced myself. There was an international genome conference held at Stellenbosch, outside Stellenbosch at the Spear Hotel. There were about 300 scientists there from all over the world, including Nobel Prize laureates. The speaker was a Dr. Stringer from the British Museum, and he was talking about skulls that they had unearthed in Tanzania. One skull in particular, he said, was 30,000 years old and measured by the carbon-14 dating method. So when question time came, and Professor Tobias was the chairman, I immediately put up my hand, and I was sitting right at the back of the hall. So he said, "You would sit at the back there." So I got up and I said, "Dr. Stringer, it is well known that you cannot measure something accurately by the carbon-14 dating method that is older than between 3,000 and 5,000 years. Could you comment on that, please?" So what happens? He gets up and he says, "Sir, you are quite right." After 10 minutes before lying to everybody that sat there, that they measured by the carbon-14 dating method. "So you are quite right. We measured the age according to the rock layer it was found in." So then I put up my hand again. So then Tobias said to me, "Sorry, you've had your question." Because Tobias knew I was going to ask the very simple question, "How do you know how old the rock is?" And then we'd have to say, "We know how old the rock is because of the kind of fossil we find in it. Because that's how you know how old the rocks are, because of the kinds of fossils you find in it." Now, lastly, before getting to the meat of the argument, I want to refer to a second book that I have on my shelf, written, by the way, not by Christian men, but by two normal, usual people who write for Scientific American. The title of the book is "Betrayers of the Truth: Fraud and Deceit in the Halls of Science." Now, on page 31, I've got a quote which says, this is on the back dust cover, "In its deceptions of examples from astronomy, physics, biology, and medicine, Betrayers of the Truth reveals how the supposedly fail-safe mechanisms of scientific inquiry often do fail to correct both the minor and major frauds that have been endemic to modern science. From the tidying up of experimental data and the fudging of statistics to the invention of whole scientific experiments out of thin air, the book examines the various means by which fraud is committed and how it can remain undetected for months, years, or even centuries. And it incisively analyzes how the lures of careerism and big money and the huge research factories common in modern science frequently lead modern scientists to betray their commitment to the discovery of the truth and to abandon the lofty ideals of their profession. Betrayers of the Truth is about how science really works, or doesn't, and why scientists are tempted to cheat. It shows that corruption and deceit, think of South Africa, that corruption and deceit are just as common in science as in any other human undertaking, providing us with a vivid picture of what science actually is: more human, less idealistic, but, and I chuckle at this, as dramatic and exciting as ever. So that's on the dust cover of that book, which I have on my shelf and I've read a couple of times. By the way, there is a science professor of the philosophy of science from the UCLA, Professor Feyerabend, who said, science is an anarchistic movement. Because of its subjectivity, science, and don't laugh, should receive equal status with astrology and witchcraft. Now that's quite steep. So do not be bluffed into thinking that science occupies an untouchable throne of honesty and truth. As far as evolution is concerned, the exact opposite is true. Now, with that as background, we now look at five of the favorite proofs, in inverted commas for his sake, of evolutionary doctrine, which we are, as the public, are bombarded with. Out of the many that evolutionists offer as scientific evidence for evolution, I've selected the following. The Big Bang, the origin of life by spontaneous generation, the fossil record, the process of evolution from slime to Socrates, and fifthly, dating methods employed to prove long ages. Now, under each of these headings, I will attempt to sketch in brief what they say and how it happened, and then I will attempt to say why I do not believe it to be true. Now, coming to the first one, the Big Bang, and I want immediately to say that last night there was it yesterday afternoon, advertised a book from the Creation Ministries called Dismantling the Big Bang. A very worthwhile book to read, and much of what I have to say about the Big Bang comes out of that book, written by real scientists and not guys like me. So rest assured. The Big Bang started, according to these scientists, with what is called a singularity. Now, you don't have to remember all of these things, but just follow the argument through and get the gist of it. It was started with what is called a singularity, whatever that might mean, of course, where all matter, energy, space, and time of the universe is contained in an infinitesimally small point of infinite temperature and density. You got that? Because I haven't. How anybody could dare to say they know this to be a fact is scientifically totally impossible. It is pure speculation, based on a presupposition which through the years has gained respectability, a respectability which it does not deserve. Why? Simply because evolution has nothing else to offer. They are in fact flogging a dead horse, but with all the other theories that they've had of the string theory and the panspermia of life coming from outer space and all of what they offer, every one of them has been proved to be totally impossible. But since they have nothing else on offer, they still cling onto this. I remember I've got an article in a Time magazine of about 3 years ago which said the Big Bang may be shot. And within the one article, the latest results of NASA proved that, hey, there's something dramatically wrong with this theory. And within the article's compass, it reduced the 15,000 million years to 8,000 million years. I mean, that's half the time in one article in the Time magazine. Now, coming back to this Big Bang, the second thing which happened is that the universe suddenly underwent a near instantaneous inflation by 1,000 billion 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 times. The Big Bang, however, was not enough. Another bang was needed, which accelerated an unimaginable process into another an unimaginable process. Its purpose was to make sure everything is thoroughly homogeneous, or as other people say, homogeneous, as it careered out into space. Because that is what is now seen in space, this homogeneous state of affairs, which is called the cosmic microwave backgrounds, CMBR in short, which is constant throughout the universe, they discovered. So something must have caused it, and so they push that into the theory and pat it nicely to make it fit into the whole theory of the Big Bang. Then the third thing happened. About 1 second, I mean, all of that's happened in, as we say in Afrikaans, a breekdeel van 'n sekond, in a fraction of a second. A second after the Big Bang and its inflationary bigger bang, stable atomic nuclei developed. How? Well, don't ask such silly questions. These are of hydrogen, which has one proton only, with smaller amounts of helium, some lithium and deuterium nuclei. Now, due to intense radiation, they say, they did not form into atoms. So for the next 100,000 years, I wonder who dreamed up that date, the expansion continued. The temperature dropped, and the electrons began to match up with the protons. You don't even know what that means. So that normal atomic structures developed, all on their own, of course, all without any design or purpose, since evolution, per definition, is directionless. It's on the way to nowhere, and everything has happened by chance. Then the fourth thing which happened was that the radiation fog cleared from about 300,000 years ago onwards, and the universe is now a transparent mass of expanding hydrogen, with lesser amounts of helium and traces of the other two, lithium and deuterium. At this point, the power of the Big Bang fades out after the conversion of energy into matter. Who worked out this timetable? Well, evolutionists did, because they needed all of that time, right up to the 15,000 million years, to land up with a universe that we now see outside at night. Now, this presupposes that the outward, natural, and unhindered results of an explosion, I mean, we all know what happens in an explosion. It goes out from the middle point in all directions, and in this event, there was nothing to stop it. There was no air outside there, because there was nothing. All outside of that singularity, there was nothing. So there was nothing to stop it going forever and ever and ever and ever and ever, and not to stop. But some miracle happened, and it all stopped somehow. And the Big Bang faded out. This presupposes that the whole thing was thrown into reverse to make the next stage possible. Now I want to ask, is there anybody in this room who can imagine an outward racing explosion that would stop and decide, okay, boys, we've had enough. Let's go back to where we came from. Anybody? All right, I was going to ask, please raise your hands, but maybe you feel a bit shy to do that. In spite of all the structures that began to form in the universe, the stars and the galaxies, a billion years after the Big Bang. In other words, and as I have just said, the outward expanding gas had to stop so as to collapse into stars and galaxies. Stephen Hawking, the very well-known Cambridge professor, cannot explain why this reverse process itself stopped before it disappeared back into the singularity out of which it came. In other words, the point from where it started. The fifth thing that happened, then follows the period where our solar system, Earth and life formed, supposedly 5 billion years ago. But the Earth is not made of gas, but of rock and metal, which could not have been produced by the Big Bang. So it must have come from elsewhere. And of course then they suggest that the first generation stars were unstable and exploded and produces the metallic elements in their stardust. Now you must have a pretty vivid imagination to think of that one, but you've got to think of something because you must have an answer. So there it is. Does it sound credible to you? Does it agree with evidence? Is it internally consistent? Or does it ignore contradictions by inserting ad hoc miracles? So my reply, or rather the reply of real scientists whom I've read, is the following. One, to start with, all of what I've said is one massive assumption, because no human being was there. And neither can or could the process be repeated in the laboratory. So it is not science. If you cannot go into a laboratory or somewhere, like this experiment in Switzerland recently, costing billions of dollars, you can't go somewhere and make the thing happen again. You've got not a leg to stand on. Hawking admitted, and again I'm thinking of Stewart, but I've got to say these things, Hawking admitted at the singularity general relativity and all other physical laws would break down. One couldn't predict what would come out of the singularity. This means that one might as well cut the Big Bang and any event before it out of the theory of origins, because they have no effect on what we observe out there. That comes out of his Brief History of Time, page 122. Now, as Williams and Hartnett say in this book, Dismantling the Big Bang, if the tools don't work and the explosion is hypothetical, then the beginning scenario in the Big Bang theory is indistinguishable from what? A miracle. So there we get to the miracle of creation of which we read in the scriptures. Thirdly, I want to say, no violent explosion has ever produced a precise result, they say. But our universe appears to be so finely tuned that Professor Stephen Mayer of the Discovery Institute in the USA was led to say that, and here is his quote again, the expansion rate of the universe is fine-tuned to one part in a trillion, 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 trillion. That is, if it were changed by one part in either direction, a little faster or a little slower, we could not have a universe that would be capable of supporting life. Fourthly, another scientist, Treffel, in his book The Dark Side of the Universe, has this to say: there shouldn't be galaxies out there at all. And even if there are galaxies, they shouldn't be grouped together the way they are. It is one of the thorniest problems in cosmology. Fifthly, Nobel Prize physicist Hannes Alfvén, in an article in the Los Angeles Times of 1979, note, that is now 30 years ago, that the Big Bang, and I quote, is unbelievable, ridiculous, and fanatical. Strong words. End of quote. He pointed out that of the 90 requirements for it to work, how many could you guess were present? One. One only. So I think that by now you've got the message. Anybody who has the right to ask, why do scientists continue to believe in the Big Bang? For the very, very simple reason, they have got nothing else to offer. My second point I want to talk about is the origin of life by spontaneous generation. Now, before the time of Pasteur, whom we all know about, scientists believed that life did arise spontaneously. Fruit flies came from fruits, geese from barnacles, mice from dirty clothes, and bees from dead calves. But Pasteur proved all this to be wrong, since life, and this is the principle, life could only come from life. It could never come from non-life. This truth has never been falsified scientifically. Evolutionists tell us, however, that, one, that there was just the right atmosphere around the Earth at that time, but it was totally different from what it is now. Now, I address that in the appendix in this book. Secondly, that the groundwater or the ocean where life began also had just the right balance of chemicals in it, which now it doesn't have either. So you can't go to the ocean and yank out these chemicals, say, these are the chemicals, because they're not there anymore. Thirdly, that from an unknown source, just the right amount of energy had to be there to produce amino acids in sufficient quantities to combine into lots of proteins and nucleotides, which then formed themselves into various organs inside a main organism. The only possible source evolutionists could come up with was a bolt of lightning. Now, have you ever seen that a bolt of lightning would be treated kindly with anything that it hits? I mean, a 220-volt plug is probably what was needed, but a bolt of lightning would have destroyed everything before it. So it could not have been a bolt of lightning, but they've got nothing else on offer, because nobody had 220 plugs at the time of creation, in their terms. The fourth thing, this organism, which miraculously came through life on its own, after some careful thinking, which scientists admit far beyond the mental abilities of present-day scientists, developed a genetic code. Now, that genetic code is the DNA. You've all heard about DNA. And that the creation of that DNA had to cover thousands, millions, billions of different requirements that had to be in place to get the results of all the kinds of life that we see on Earth today, whether it be plant material or humans or animals or whatever, anything with life in it. had to come and be encoded in this DNA. Because that is the list of requirements you'll find for everything is in DNA for humans. And a professor of biology, I think it was, at Free State University, who spoke about them wanting to commemorate Darwin's birth in the 10th of February or something, that we differ from the chimpanzees only by 2%. I mean, he said, we are not family of the chimpanzees, we are chimpanzees, with such a small difference. I mean, he may be, but I am certainly not. But you see, I often use the example as an architect of a heap of building material. I say, I've got 50,000 bricks, I've got 25 cubic meters of timber, I've got glass, I've got how many tons of steel, and you name it, all the other things that you can think of that you put into a building, thatch, poles, curtains, doors, windows, everything. I've got two heaps of material like that. Out of the one, using all of that material, I design and I build a church. Now, I've built, designed 100 churches in Southern Africa, so in that area I know something of what I'm talking about. But I've also designed one of the biggest buildings in Cape Town, which is a government building, and say now that my second heap of material built that building. All of the material is exactly the same, but it is the way it is put together which makes the difference. And where does the way of putting together come from? Out of my mind. I decided that that is going to be a church and that is going to be a government building. And I decided how it was going to be put together. I got engineers to help me, like this engineer sitting over here. Luckily, else it may have fallen down. But the disciplines together decide, the architect decides what's going to happen, and guys like him, engineers, help. And the quantity surveyor puts it all in thick books. They were about that thick, laid on the table. 240 architect's drawings. That makes a building. It is designed from start to finish. And so I thought I'd mention that as an illustration. Of course, maybe my second illustration is probably a bit better. This development, this evolution of life, according to evolutionists, can be illustrated with this illustration, namely that take an ordinary bicycle on which you are riding. You're pedaling away, and while you're pedaling away, it changes into a motor scooter. You don't stop, because you can't stop, because then it would be dead in evolutionary terms. So it changes into a motor scooter, and then miraculously, after riding on this for 150,000 years, it changes into a proper motorbike. You know, 500cc BMW or 1000cc BMW motorbike. But while that has happened for a few million years, it changes into a four-cylinder motor car. While it's running, of course. And then it changes into an eight-cylinder monster, all without stopping. The only difference between that and the evolutionistic miracles is that all of that happens in the DNA. The DNA provides all the answers, and there it is. You and I, we can't, not supposed to argue with that. But a very well-known scientist, Sir Frederick Hoyle, wrote in the November 19, 1981 issue of The New Scientist that, and I quote, there are 2,000 complex enzymes required for a living organism. 2,000. Yet not a single one of these could have been formed on Earth by shuffling processes of genes in even 20 billion years. And he was no creationist. Fifthly, in addition to the above, everything would have to be in place suddenly. In structure, arrangement, coordination, coding, chemical makeup, feeding, elimination of waste, respiration, breathing in and out, circulation, because this is a living organism, circulation and all the rest, everything would have to be in perfect order and position right from the start. The formation of amino acids, proteins, DNA, enzymes, all needed to occur within a single moment. Otherwise, a moment later, the organism would be dead. Now, Johannes, another good book down there, written by Professor Michael Behe, a very strange name, Darwin's Black Box. And there you find an outstanding example, and which he uses the mousetrap. If you haven't got the five components of the mousetrap there all together, you haven't got a mousetrap. You can have four, you can have five, but if they're the wrong size, the wrong placing in relation to one another, you still haven't got a mousetrap. So to have a proper mousetrap, all five must be present, they must be in the correct position of the correct size, and then somebody must activate it. You've got to pull over the clamp which is going to kill the mouse, and you've got to set it so finely that it will actually close when the mouse jumps onto the trap. Now, highly trained scientists in our day, even in their multi-million dollar laboratories, cannot succeed in performing what they believe happened spontaneously in a pond of slime. However, sixthly, if all the required chemicals were to have been present in the water or the slime pond, the water would immediately destroy the needed enzymes. You don't have to know what that is, it's just a requirement, a living thing, an enzyme. Fats, sugars, and nucleic acids can come from proteins only by a careful removal of fluid. So proteins cannot exist in water, they tell me, where we are told that all must have come into being to start with. So you can already see that spontaneous generation is in deep trouble. Seventhly, the necessity for an extremely rich mixture of chemicals required for the formation of the first living molecule demands that somewhere on this planet, such sediments ought to be present. Because if it isn't present somewhere before all this life began, you know, where would it all come from? But no such materials have been found anywhere on Earth. There is, in other words, pretty good negative evidence that there never was a primordial organic soup on this planet that could have lasted but for a moment. That quote comes from a book by scientists J. Brooks and G. Shaw, Origins and Development of Living Systems. And yes, I have two more things to say about spontaneous generation. Protein is a basic constituent of all life forms. It's composed of amino acids, none of which can produce the other. So how were they made? How could they make themselves? And the simplest of them is something called glycine, could not form by chance due to the inadequate chemicals that were not there, that were required to produce the reactions. So if one were to have come about by chance, it would have to hunt through 1,029 other molecules in the ocean before finding another glycine amino acid to link up with, because they must link up. Don't ask me why, that's the requirement. This is equal, the scientists say, this is equal to finding one person in a crowd of 100 million, million, million times larger than all the people that have ever lived on this earth. Now that seems pretty steep odds. The research team at Balian University in Israel concluded that no protein ever was produced by chance on this earth. And the last thing concerning spontaneous generation, the problem of oxygen. Without a non-oxygen atmosphere, biological chemicals could not form. Oxygen was not to be there. But at the same time, they would die for the lack of oxygen. So now you really are in a fix. So spontaneous generation could never occur, neither with oxygen or without. So whichever way you go, you can't. It's a no-go. It cannot possibly happen. I come now to the third point, and that is the fossil record. Now this is really interesting, and probably something most of you can relate to more easily. And I regard this as the most abused aspect of science there is. You have a knee-jerk reaction upon hearing the word fossils, don't you? And you all must think in terms of millions and millions of years. And the media makes sure that you and I are led to believe that this is true. All of those millions of years are required. Now, for 150 years, the world has been brainwashed into believing that the geological column seen in every museum in the world, barring one or two that are Christian, represents the history of geological time. After all, there are the 10 layers, generally 10, sometimes 12. I think South African geological column is 12. But generally, I have 10 layers. And there you can see them. There's the illustration. There you've got the bedrock. And there you have the Cambrian layer. And so you go on of the Silurian layer and the Cretaceous layer and all the other layers. Fancy, fancy names that none of us can remember. So there they are. But not only that, you've also got a table of thickness. And when you look at the table, you can simply write down on a piece of paper how deep each of these layers is. And if you add them all up together, you come to 135.8 kilometers in depth. Now that's quite deep. Now, the question is, how much has been measured in truth around the world since that column was drawn up? Now the deepest, according to specialist researcher Dr. John Woodmorap, the depth varies between 12 and 25 kilometers, or 8 to 16% of the total depth given on this sacred geological column. This information, by the way, comes out of Creation Science Researchers' Vital Articles on Science. And how many places on Earth are the 10 illustrated on that geological column layers to be found? According to Dr. Stephen Austin, who has now joined Creation Ministries, apparently, a mere 0.4% of places on Earth do you find these 10 layers like it is illustrated in the geological column. 70%, according to Dr. Austin, of the layers are missing in 77% of the Earth's surface sediments. So here we are dealing with blatant misrepresentation. You see, nobody bothers to add up these depths. I did. I also took the years they allot to each one, 560 million years, 290 million years, 120 million years. And it also looks and sounds so authentic, because, I mean, who can argue with these dates? it is not only depth in kilometers, but it's time. And the time, when you add all of that time up, comes to 4,600 million years. Now, if you look at the reality of the situation, of an average of 12% of this fictitious geological column, you come to, out of the 4.6 billion years worked out, you come to only 736,000 years. Now that is a dramatic difference. So your lie is now reduced by something like 85%. Now I'm not going to labor the points any further. In practically all the sites on Earth, the layers are either not there in that order, as I've said, or they are in a different sequence. Further, this rate of deposition, I spoke of that, these layers were laid down according to the uniformitarian evolutionistic presupposition, all very big words, but they say that everything was uniformly laid down in minute layers. And how thick does it come out per annum? If you divide the 135 kilometers by the 4,600 million years, how thick is each layer? The thickness, which I worked out with great difficulty, is 0.03 millimeters per annum. Now, that's not much. You will agree. A thickness of a very thin hair. Now, all of the fossils in the world are found in these rock layers. Now, can you imagine a tadpole being fossilized? A tadpole which is, say, 6-10 millimeters high when lying on its side, and at a rate of 0.03 millimeters per annum of uniformitarian laying down of sediments, it would take 233 years for a tadpole to fossilize. Now, how many here believes that that would be possible, that would be anything left of the tadpole within 1 month? Hands up. Nobody. But this is what is presented to the unsuspecting public out there. There are four things that must be present if you want a fossil to exist at all. Number one, the animal must die. Number two, once dead, the animal must instantaneously be covered and totally covered in mud. Number three, all oxygen must instantly and forever thereafter be excluded, else it would rot away. Number four, it must remain covered entirely in that position until the mud solidifies in rock, after the bones have been penetrated with chemicals from the mud, turning them into fossils. So without those four requirements, you'll never have a fossil. It had to be entirely covered instantaneously. So you can immediately see evolution could not have been the cause of this. But you see in museums these layers, and with the smallest of fossils at the bottom, and as you go up in the geological column, you see bigger and bigger and bigger animals, up to the dinosaurs of 65 million years ago, and so on. Now that looks pretty convincing. Because, I mean, there it is. I mean, it's cast in stone. So how could have that happened other than through evolution? Because the bottom ones have died out, and as you go up there, you get the larger things, and they have died out, and we are left now only with a smattering of animal types. So how could this possibly have happened other than that way? Now, I want to present to you that there is one very cogent answer to that question. The flood of Genesis is the best scientific answer to this geological column. The flood of Noah, where the waters came up from under the earth And I won't labor you with all details, but the possibilities, there's the mid-Atlantic ridge under the oceans, which is broken up, which seems to demonstrate that the water and many other things came out from under the earth, and that if you take America and South Africa, and you get the shoreline, and then you get the continental shelf dropping 6 to 10 kilometers, and then the bed of the ocean, then in the middle of that you've got this crack running around the whole world. That out of that the waters came up, and then between the two continents the floor of the ocean just sank as the waters came out. This is a theory, by the way, a Christian's theory of where the water came from. And then the other water came from the band of water around the globe spoken of in Genesis. So the flood of Noah fits like a glove into what the geological column shows of various layers, then organized in this order, then organized in the reverse order, then organized such that one layer will come in and vanish to nothing and another one will start, as waters came from different sides, containing all of this mud of different characters and laying itself down all over the entire globe, and within it are fossils. Those fossils that could not run fast enough or creep fast enough are all at the bottom, and the faster they could move, the higher up they are in the geological column. Does that not sound a lot more reasonable than this 4.6 thousand million years? So the Genesis flood, to my mind, is the perfect answer. People are hoodwinked to accept the millions of years as an undeniable process. And they will never, never admit or even talk about the biblical flood. Because if the flood were to be true, their whole house of cards falls apart. Now, by now you must have got my drifts, and I'm not referring to the ark drifting on the waters of the world. Only a worldwide catastrophe could have caused the fossils to form. No flood equals no fossils. Because there's invariably, in a present flood, if there were to be a present flood, there's always a place to which the animals can flee. And why do you not find, or very, very few, human fossils in the fossil record? Because humans had more brains and fled to the highest point they could see. You find many fossil graveyards in the Velikovsky's books, you read about them, fossil graveyards in valleys where it goes into between kranzes that they can't get up. But the animal hasn't got the brain to know if he goes into there, he can't get out. But the human will look and say, boy, I can't go up there, so I better go around this business. So there are hardly any human fossils. And that when humans got to the highest points, well, then the water took over and they were either eaten by fish, sharks, or they'd simply rotted. But there are notable exceptions to this. Now I come fourthly to the process of evolution. But now you realize I don't have to spend any time on this misconception. There was no process, because everything speaks against it. Even Richard Dawkins admits there's more information in a DNA molecule than there is in a whole set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And if Richard Dawkins admits that, then we'd better sit up and take notice. Did it create itself? And if so, how could it have created itself? I mean, it's like me using my computer, that I decide I need to write this article in my computer, but I don't have to do anything actually. The computer will do it. The material will do it. I don't have to do anything. No intelligence is necessary. So if this talk could have been, or has been, produced, here it is, you can see it, has been produced by my computer, then evolution is true. Now, just the last nail in the coffin of the so-called process of evolution. In my earlier book, it's not here now, my very first book, I refer to Darcy Thompson, a scientist who spent 40 years of his life to prove Darwinist evolution. He was a mathematician, and he was bent on showing the world that the underlying structures of all animals are related. He wrote a book called On Growth and Form. It's a book I read 59 years ago and reread recently. 40 years of research made him admit, brought him to the point where he had to admit that each time he was faced with an impregnable barrier between species. The algebra refused to work out. Now, I've got in here one little reference to him. I can't find the page at the moment. The algebra would not work out how that the bones of this animal here would develop into this kind of animal and would develop into the next kind. It would not work out. He says there's an unbridgeable gap between that kind and this kind and that kind over there. So at the end of his life's work, he says, sorry boys, this has been a wild goose chase. And now I need to read from 1 Corinthians 15, verses 38 to 41. 1 Corinthians, and this is a remarkable passage in the scriptures. But God gives it a body. Think now of Darcy Thompson. God gives it a body, and to each seed its own body. All flesh is not the same, but there is one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animals, another of fish, and another of birds. There are also celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies, but the glory of the celestial is one, and the glory of the terrestrial is another. There is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars. For one star of the billions differs from another star in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead. The body is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. What a fantastic passage of scripture. And of course, this is what science is discovering, that all of these things are different, each to each his own. All of the kinds are different, are special creations. And thank God, you and I are also his special creation. Now, about the dating methods, lastly, I don't want to say too much, I could. Now, every one of evolutionistic doctrines is based on dating methods of some kind or another. And the very popular carbon-14 one, as I mentioned before, is the one that is used greatly. Why? Because it gives you the greatest, longest periods of time. There are other methods which give you far lesser periods of time, but they don't like using them because they want all the time, you see, to enable evolution to take place. It means that if there had been and was a universal flood, the whole cosmic system would have been mixed up, and that there was no uniformitarian basis on which one could date any system. So with something as catastrophic as a flood and the cosmic impacts on the world, you couldn't possibly date anything accurate by any of these methods. Now, I'll just give you two examples. One is that they did a test on a living shellfish with one of these methods, the carbon-14 method to be exact, and it dated this living shellfish to be over 1,000 years dead, a living shellfish. Then there's the case of a Professor Arends at the University of Cape Town, whom I knew because I lectured there for 10 years and we used to have lunch together in the union. His wife had produced a painting looking like a rock painting on a piece of rock and placed it in her garden. Now, I did not find this out from him. I found it out from reading a book produced in England. That bit of rock with this painting on it was found somewhere in the veld, and somebody sent it to Oxford to the dating laboratory, and they dated this thing to be 2,300 years old, the painting. So, fortunately, Professor Arends' wife saw the illustration in her husband's magazine. And she said, but this is my rock painting. It was stolen from my garden. So there, her own, she's still alive. Her own painting on the rock is 2,300 years old. And I don't think she was quite that old. In another case, the last case I'll mention, a lava flow from an eruption in Hawaii was dated as 3 billion years old. But if you open the history books in Hawaii, take it off from the shelf and open it up, when did this happen? 190 years ago. So you can say a lot more about that, but I will not. I've come to the end of my 5 major fields of inquiry in dealing with evolutionary beliefs. I say again, it is not science, it is a belief. An atheistic faith in a presupposition that matter is all there is and that only matter matters. I repeat what Sproul said, if God is, chance is not, and if chance is, God is not. There is no other alternative. Chance has no ability to do anything since chance has no substance. Chance has no mind. You can't have life like you and me or any other life produced by mistakes in the genetic coding, because mutations are all mistakes. And nobody tells you that 99% of the mistakes, genetic mistakes, are lethal. In other words, it kills you. But if you've got nothing else to offer, that is what you offer. Now, when Bible-believing Christians speak about God being the creator of all there is, one of the first things that you hear is that you are attacking science. Therefore, the case is dismissed. Of course, that's precisely what evolutionists do. They say, you are attacking science. If you knew anything about science, you wouldn't say that this is true. But the public is unaware of the fact that they are making tens of thousands of presuppositions based on speculative thinking, which exists with the aim of removing God from the equation of how we got here. You can go into any discipline, but paleontology is the worst of them. I regard 80 to 95% of paleontology is total wishful thinking. Evolution from start to finish is pure speculation, not worthy of the attention of people with a healthy intellect and an exercised common sense. So feel pretty good if you do not believe in evolution. Take note of the following quotation. Now I've got, I don't know how much time I've got left. Have I got any time left? None at all. So I'll reduce my 12 quotes I've got here to about 4. Darwin himself said, I'm quite conscious that my speculations run quite beyond the bounds of true science. Now, who would have thought of that? World-renowned evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould admitted, "Paleontologists have paid an exorbitant price for Darwin's arguments. We fancy ourselves as the only true students of life's history. Yet, to preserve our favored account of evolution by natural selection, we view our data as so bad that we almost never see the very process we profess to study." Another one, "Evolutionism is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science." End of quote. Next quote, "The success of Darwinism was accomplished by a decline in scientific integrity." I am, just for the kicks, going to read a few more. Muggeridge, we all know, blandly states that posterity will marvel that so very flimsy and dubious an hypothesis could be accepted with the credulity that it has. "I think this age is one of the most credulous in history." Fleischmann, in Why We Believe in Creation, Not Evolution, quotes Maldow, who in that book said, "The Darwinian theory of descent has not a single fact to confirm in the realm of nature. It is not the result of scientific research, but purely the product of imagination." I will not read the others because I want to say something to mainly you as ministers of the word. I want to ask you, identify in your congregations young students who have the intellectual capacity and capabilities and potential to really learn something about the true facts of life as contained in the scriptures, but also contained in the many books of which you can get from Johann at the back there, well, I think he was there, the creation magazines, and on the websites, there are many websites, and there are, I mean, I've got books and books and books on my shelves, all supporting the biblical view of science. Identify and get the young people in your churches to read this. Get them to bring together the Bible and real science so that they can be equipped that when they go to university, they will have the answers so that they will not lose their faith. And so that a new generation of young people can be built up that have the knowledge, scientific knowledge, to counter all of these blatant lies that we hear every day of our lives. You yourself as a minister will have to inform yourself. You will have to read some of these books. And I could give you lists of them, but probably half a dozen would be sufficient. And to read it again and again, and bring it into your sermons. But also recognize that there will be philosophies apart from evolution. I recently got a thick book like this, An Introduction to Christian Philosophy, written by two outstanding American philosophers. And in fact, my very first quote, my first talk, came out of that book. You will have to study philosophy and to see how almost 99% of philosophy is bent on destroying faith in God and faith in this book, which is the authoritative word of God. I plead, I want to read this. I plead that you should be on the lookout for these false teachings and that you be instrumental in rearing a future generation who knows the truth, but who will take their places in world scholarship as the present incumbents die out because of their inability to provide lasting answers to the hard issues confronting the world of our day. Our world is falling apart because it is based on false presupposition, lies, when all of life is only to be found in the material existence and nothing of spiritual existence outside of that. May God, by His grace, see fit to use these introductory talks of mine to enthuse you to get out there, to buy these books, and to read them, and make it part and parcel of your preaching of the Word of God, the never-changing and infallible Bible. Can we pray? Our Lord and most wonderful God, we thank You that You are, and that You are the unquestioned Creator of heaven and earth, and all that is therein. That You did this in 6 days, and that You instantaneously made every kind of animal and plant and whatever on this planet. You made it for us to look after, to subdue the earth and to have dominion thereover, all in the name of God, in acknowledging You and doing it for Your glory. Help each one of us to fulfill our role, that we will not be misled into having only a so-called spiritual life, but that our intellects will also be regenerated, also saved from this iniquitous generation in which we live, so that we might be entirely new people in our minds, in our hearts, in our spirits, that we can boldly say, we belong to this true God, Creator of heaven and earth, and that we can believe in Him through His Son, who gave His life to save us, hopelessly lost individuals. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.